Hello, everyone, and welcome to another exciting edition of the Brothers Movie Factory. I'm your host, Ben. With me, as always, the brother of the Brothers Movie Factory.
The one who's close to death.
The one who knocks. Wait.
Wait, what? Ben, let me ask you, how old are you?
I am 25.
Do you want to be 26?
No.
Then you're not going to watch Pinocchio with me.
Okay. When you took a shit this morning, was it a close encounter of the turd kind? Ha ha ha.
Is that from Family Guy or something?
I'm pretty sure it is.
If you say any kind of joke, I'm just like, Family Guy?
Yeah, like, that's too creative for him. But joining me as always, Gus, the brother of the Brothers Movie Factory, Annette. And what we do here on the podcast is every week we take a film, we watch said film, we then take to the pod to discuss that film, what we liked, what we didn't, what worked, what didn't. Then we submit that movie to the factory. That's where we take the film we just watched, and we imagine what it would look like if it came out today. Who would direct it? Who would compose it? Who would star? Same film, same story. Just different cast and crew for the modern booking. So before we get into it, the movie we watched this week, again, we are doing the podcast from home. Usually we are recording in studio. Past couple weeks we have not been able to, obviously due to quarantines and things like that. So we are doing these in the comfort of our own homes with headsets, so the audio quality is a little off in comparison to what we have done in the past. But hey, stick with us. It'll be fun. All right, if you can get past our robots in disguise voices. So with that being said, this week we decided to watch Close Encounters of the Third Kind, and it was your choice. Why did you want to watch this movie?
Well, it was one rainy, cold night. Actually, I think the weather was clear, and me and Lady were watching a film, and we chose to watch Close Encounters of the Third Kind on her recommendation because she had never seen it before. So we checked it out, and I was like, you know, this has been on our list for the podcast for a while, and I always forget to, like, bring it up because I always want to save it because it's kind of a big deal movie. But it seemed opportune now because we try to stay topical, but without media being what it is or it used to be, especially, like, in the movie world, it's hard to, you know, have a subject to check out each and every week. But so I chose this film and gave it for you to borrow to watch. But upon you watching it, isn't it kind of topical? Part of it? Like a portion of it?
At the very end when they have everything quarantined down.
They get quarantined down and there's, like, you know, some kind of chemical leak and people are getting sick and dying and you're not allowed to go here, and it's like creates conspiracy theories and stuff like that. And I was like, that's what a lot of people, you know, say around here, especially when, you know, when I was working and going in people's homes and stuff, to do installations, they would say, you know, they think it's all a conspiracy theory and this and that. So it was just kind of reminiscent of those things. But also, just in general, it's, in my opinion, one of the best sci-fi films ever made, at least one of the most important. And it's been a long time since I've visited this film, and I know it's good, and I always forget how good it is, at least for me.
And true to Steven Spielberg form, it's a movie that has, like, a lot of different feels throughout. Because it has some, like, horror elements at times. It's got, like, the science fiction, like, whimsy to it at times. It's got suspense at times. It's really got a lot going for it. It's got emotion and romance, and it's cool too. and so it is kind of, I don't know if you, I thought that scene when it's Barney. Barney? Yeah, Barney. The boy, the little boy.
Barry,
not Barney. Fuck. Anyways, Barry is being kidnapped. That's, like, pretty intense and scary.
Yeah, it's pretty creepy. It's still creepy.
It's very reminiscent. I mean, I guess I should say Signs is very reminiscent of that. I felt, at least. Like, that scene. I was like, this feels like Signs.
little bit, and to a less extreme, but didn't that scene also kind of remind you, like, Poltergeist or something?
Yeah.
Even though not as extreme, and still Spielberg. But, you know, like, not only was that scene, like, creepy for us when the boy is kind of getting abducted, but the actress who plays the mother, Melinda, I can't remember her last name.
Dylan.
Yeah. There's the scene where she has her son, and the kitchen starts to, like, go crazy, and everything starts flying around the room. They didn't do, like, a test for her or anything. So she knew it was going to happen, but to experience it was a whole different thing. So when things start go flying, it was really intense for her, and it's kind of real fear, you see, as she's, like, sitting there trying to protect herself and her, you know, co-star.
That's the best type of fear.
Wait. And then he crawls out the old doggy window, and that gives me the willies.
What, climbing out a doggy window?
It'll be just a shot of him.
You're like, I've seen Scream.
Yeah. He climbs out the doggy door, and he gets sucked away by the aliens. Freaks me out.
Hey, he's going to play.
Toys!
Yeah, I'm like, you idiot.
he's a good little actor, though, that little boy.
Is he in a lot of other stuff?
I don't really know. I didn't look him up, but
Cary Guffrey.
Yeah, he was 3 years old while they were filming, and he was so good. They called him One Take Cary because it rarely did they need to do more than one take. Spielberg even had shirts made that said that.
He has 10 films to his name.
Okay.
Close Encounters of the Third Kind was his first, and he retired from acting in 85.
Okay, so he only acted roughly for eight years.
He was in a lot of different TV shows and TV movies.
Right. He was very directable and just gave, like, the right expressions that Spielberg was going for. Like, when he gives that reaction where he says, toys, but he's, like, looking at the aliens, supposedly, Spielberg, behind the camera, while, you know, Barry was looking in his direction, Spielberg would pull out from behind his back like a toy truck. And then Barry would be like, toys!
Write that down!
The part where, it's just showing Barry, and he's, like, looking, and you can tell he's looking at something, someone or something. And you hear the noise, too. And he smiles. In the film, he's looking at what we are to perceive as aliens. We don't see them. We see Barry's reaction. But, you know, while they're filming, he had two, I don't know who they were, but two people dressed in a clown suit and one dressed in a gorilla suit. So he's, like, looking both ways. And then Spielberg told the gorilla suit guy to take off his mask to, like, create a surprise. And that's when, in the film, Barry smiles. So he's, like, looking at aliens and he, like, smiles, but really he's looking at two things that should terrify a child.
A clown and a giant monkey. You're like, wait a minute.
Yeah. So when was the last time you had checked out Close Encounters of the Third Kind?
Honestly, could not tell you. When I was probably in high school. But I really do not remember the last time I watched this movie. I mean, it's one of those, though, that I remember everything that's going on. It's, like, it's so iconic, I guess, that, like, as I was watching it, there wasn't a moment where I was like, I completely forgot about this. It stuck with me. I remembered pretty much all of the movie as I was going through it. And I really like Richard Dreyfuss as an actor. And I think he's phenomenal in this. As he is in everything, but like I said, joked with you, I'm like, he probably thought this was shit.
He actually kind of did, because like a lot of their acting in this movie was to show expression towards nothing. So as the director would say, there'd be like visual effects, spaceships are flying by, bright lights, all kinds of crazy things. As an actor, you're not seeing any of that. You're told to react to what it would look like. So when they see the final product and they see the actual ships and the aliens flying by and all that kind of stuff, paired with their performance, that's what they get from the final product. So upon seeing the final product, Richard Dreyfuss was a little
Hey, slow down there, guy. You're
like, if I would have known it would look like this, I would have acted way different.
Can you hear me? You're really breaking up.
Oh.
Like through that entire thing, I was like, "Slow down, guy!" And you just kept going. I'm like, "Slow down."
I couldn't hear you. Because there must have been some kind of disconnection. I am seeing where it's voice connected. It's now full bars, but when you said that, I looked over and it was in the red.
Yeah, that's just the server distance. Sometimes it goes. I mean, I could understand everything you were saying. It just it was a rough listen.
I basically said he, you know, as an actor, you're told to react to nothing. This is a big special effect thing. So in the final product, when Richard Dreyfuss did get to see all the crazy visual effects, he was disappointed in his performance. He would have reacted way different if he knew it was going to look like this. In true Richard Dreyfuss fashion.
Yeah, I mean, he's the true professional. Or the true pessimist, I don't know.
But, you know, just touch on Richard Dreyfuss. He is kind of the heart and soul of the story. And you just mentioning that you've rewatched this for the first time in a long time. The concept of this film is pretty, I don't want to say basic, but is nothing too crazy in that it's, at its core, it's about the everyman who has a close encounter, and it kind of spirals his life into a whole different direction, which causes stress for himself and his family and his world, really. And he's kind of drawn to, well, the unexplainable. And then you have your other characters kind of subsequently doing the same thing. But at its heart, for us as the audience to relate to the everyman, played by Richard Dreyfuss, and following him on this journey into madness.
You also feel bad because you also, as a viewer, know what he saw when everyone else is like, nope, you didn't see that.
Right.
Trying to deal, you got that dramatic irony rolling.
Yeah, especially when he's interacting with his wife, who just doesn't understand and won't understand, and ultimately, you know, takes the kids and leaves them kind of thing. You really feel for him, and he's confused, wants to understand, and is acting strange because of it. You sympathize with him, and you get upset when, you know, people aren't on board with him.
Hey, honey, where are you going? She jumps up on the car, and she just fucking takes off.
He takes that lady's chicken wire.
I'm going to pay you for this.
She points a hairdryer at him, like, take it!
That's best type of weapon.
I believe, also, this is Spielberg's, like, second theatrical film. Isn't that something wild just to think about?
Really?
He did Duel. I'm pretty sure that was a made-for-TV movie. I could be wrong about that. I always forget if it was or wasn't. They did Jaws, of course.
I'm pretty sure Duel was. Sounds right.
And then while he was working on Jaws, he got this job, Close Encounters. And then because of the success of Jaws, he got basically full control to do whatever he wanted with this film.
Was this his idea?
Yes, so he wanted to do an alien vehicle film, like a story about aliens back in like 1973, but he wanted to do it about like almost like a documentary about people who have experienced aliens and have had their lives changed because of it. And he was inspired by this doctor. I actually have his name here, one sec. Oh, of course, my phone. Does that ever happen to you? Like, you're on an app, and like Google or something, and then you like close your phone, and when you open it again, it's just gone. Like, you have to re-find what you were looking for. And by doing that, that gave me the time to fill up this little second so I can look up this name. But Dr. J. Allen Hynek, who was an alien skeptic. But over his experiences and studies, he basically can't ignore the evidence of potential alien life. So being a skeptic, but being able to come to that conclusion that he's not a believer, but it's like undeniable that there's something out there, that doctor inspired Spielberg to create a film basically not about aliens, but like people being able to accepted as being undeniable kind of thing.
Yeah.
So he wanted to make a movie based around that. Now, he's given writing credit for this movie. He did not write the screenplay. He worked with a writer to do this, but
through his ideas and stuff.
To the point where it wasn't the guy's film anymore, the guy's script anymore. So he kind of backed away and didn't want credit for it. So they're left with a film with no credited writer, so Spielberg, you know, took the credit, I guess.
Spielberg's not, like, notorious for being hard to work for, is he?
No, I don't believe so. I just think originally it was about a police officer who experienced this phenomenon. Then it turned into a military man, an army officer or something. And that's what they were going with for a long time. And out of nowhere, Spielberg kind of decided that, you know, we, as an audience, typically we can't relate to a police officer in this fashion, the way he was wanting us to experience the film through. We can't experience a character who's in the army or the military. He had the idea to do the everyday man. And he wanted to change it to that, and the writer was like, this isn't my film anymore kind of thing. Because it changed a lot of the aspects of the movie.
Yeah, and looking at his credit here, Spielberg's credits, the first thing that I can say, most of his films say, like, short TV series, Duel was a TV movie. Way back in 1964, there was a movie called Firelight that doesn't say... It doesn't say it was a made-for-TV movie. It doesn't say it was a short. It just says Firelight, which is how all his other movies are. So that might have been his first theatrical film.
No. So Firelight is actually his movie. Like, that's his creation. How we make movies on the side. Like, Firelight was his movie that he made when he was really young and, like, submitted it to, like, festivals and stuff.
Oh, okay.
That's the movie that got him a lot of, like, attention, that studios are like, hey, give him a job.
Well, then, after Duel, he did a couple other TV movies. He did Something Evil and Savage, and then The Sugar Land Express in 1974 was his first theatrical movie.
Okay.
When Sugarland Express, Jaws, Close Encounters of the Third Kind, 1941, Raiders of the Lost Ark, Twilight Zone, the movie.
Oh boy.
Yeah.
Yeah. So being just like early in his career, coming out with those big hits like Jaws and Close Encounters of the Third Kind, Sugarland Express is regarded pretty high too.
Goldie Hawn.
Yeah. So. Knowing that and seeing this, like, for me, this achievement in filmmaking was really impressive. And, you know, this film, amongst cinephiles, it's not overlooked. But I feel like as time has gone on, people don't really think of this movie too much when they talk about, like, their favorite Spielberg movies or even their favorite sci-fi movies. Just because... over time, the idea of what sci-fi is has kind of changed, but the same year this movie came out, it was a big hit. Same year, Star Wars came out, you know. So people kind of think of that for 1977 as like the sci-fi film of the times.
Indeed. I mean,
it should be. But.
I enjoy it. I don't necessarily... Like I said, it's not a movie I watch very often, because it's not action-packed by any sense of the means. It's you're just watching a story unfold, so to some, I could see it maybe being considered a little boring.
It's very cerebral.
Yeah.
You know, it's the thinking man sci-fi.
I mean, and I think it's very good. You just kind of sit back and enjoy it and watch everything unfold and kind of slip into madness with them, because you don't really know where the movie's going to take you either.
No, and that's what makes it so, for me, exciting to follow the character's journey, because as he is confused and wants answers, so are you as the viewer, and you just kind of let it unfold before you, which I think is really well done.
Yeah, I think too, I guess we should kind of discuss the relationship between, like, him and his wife obviously deteriorates, and it's deteriorating even at the beginning. I told you that. That was, like, one thing I didn't remember. Like, they were having a pretty rough marriage to begin with. But then the him with Jillian, the girl, the other girl, they're, like, kind of drawn to each other almost immediately.
Yeah, kind they of have deal. This common connection. It's a very intimate connection, not with each other. They have this intimate connection to what they saw, what they experienced. So they're drawn to that. So naturally, they're kind of drawn to each other. And it's not like, you know, I never felt like a romance between the two, other than there is a love there. But it's not the typical, like, cinema love.
Nah.
It's more like a friend love.
Even though they kiss, though.
Yeah, you kiss your friends, don't you?
All the time. What?
So, what was I going to say? I do love this movie for a lot of just little things that they incorporate in the movie that are just really nice, exciting touches. Like, at the very beginning, and they're in the desert, and they find all those World War II airplanes. Like, that is a real event that happened in our history. Like, the Flight 19 in World War, in 1945, these planes disappeared. Flying over the Bermuda Triangle, never to be seen again. And in real life, still have never been found. And they incorporate them into this film, like they suddenly appeared in the desert. Later in the movie, there's that ship that's in the Gobi Desert. Also disappeared in the Bermuda Triangle in 1920. So I like those little touches, but one of the best scenes in the movie was when they're in India and all the gathering people are doing the, they're actually saying, something in Hindi, and it translates to, he has risen.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So that's pretty cool, like a little touch there. But yeah, the reason that scene's so amazing, gives me goosebumps just talking about it. They're all chanting that, and then that person like screams like, "Where did you hear this?" And they all point to the sky. Like, that's great, great shot too.
Yeah, I that was another scene. I guess I didn't quite remember. But no, I like that. I do like that they tied it to real. I like the scene at the very beginning too, when the when it's like air traffic control is talking to the pilots and they're like explaining what they see, and it is kind of topical, because even recently the Air Force or was it the Navy, either or, they released UFO footage.
That was very similar to that in 1977.
Yeah, so it's like they can't describe what they said. They're like, "Do you want to report a UFO?" And they're like, "No, that's okay. We don't really know what to describe." And that's almost that's almost like a thing that you'd see with, like, nowadays. Like, they don't know how to describe it. They don't want to seem crazy, so they're like, "It's fine."
Yeah, that's good stuff. But even in the end, the finale goes like this. I describe Close Encounters of the Third Kind. I say, you know, what I said earlier, the journey of the common man, you know, experiencing this strange phenomenon. But I always like to end when I describe it as the film proceeds to like a crescendo of beauty. Because I find that finale just riveting, and just, there's not much dialogue It's mostly just interactions with people, just like saying like do this, do that, like, and you're just sitting back and experiencing these people, seeing these alien ships, these bright lights, and them talking through music, this sound. And I guess we should talk about that sound, because that's probably the most iconic thing about this movie.
Is how they speak.
Yeah, those five tones. Seen in so many other films, is parodied and incorporated into, much like, I'll put it like the Matrix bullet dodge.
Yeah.
You see that everywhere, and you hear the Close Encounters theme everywhere, but I'll go as far to say is this is one of John Williams' best scores, for me, personally. And that's saying a lot. I'm not saying it's his best, but it's up there. I would say top 10, maybe in top 5 best scores.
I mean, I think, too, just the overall sound in the movie outside of the music is pretty intense. Even without mm-hmm. the music, like that scene at the end where they are speaking with the mothership and everything and kind of discussing and it like hits like burr, 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 like it starts going and mm-hmm. it's really loud and bassy and stuff. It's all very good. You know, something I never really noticed is that mothership is like a whole full-blown city.
Yeah,
like when you look at it, like there's like skyscrapers and stuff. I never noticed that before, because it looks a lot like the E.T. mothership.
They actually modeled it after, like, an Indian oil rig facility.
Really?
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it looks really cool. The design's neat. I never noticed it's, like, a full-blown little city going on there.
Yeah, that thing is humongous.
Yeah, yeah. Didn't realize. But, all in all, very good movie. And I really think it's one that pretty much everyone should see at least once in their life, because while it might not be everyone's cup of tea, I think it's an important step in cinema, and especially sci-fi storytelling.
Definitely the slow burn, like you said, kind of movie, but there are things that should be experienced. Like, at one point, this movie was known as the loudest movie ever made at one point. Like on the decibel level, which a fun story that I can harken back to. I'd seen this movie on TV and whatnot and rented it before, but I bought it on Blu-ray, the same Blu-ray I had you borrow. And I watched it on my old surround sound system long ago. And, at the end, when they're communicating with the alien mothership and, they kick off with the big noise, the brum, brum, and the speaker blows in the movie, my rear speaker went and stopped working.
Hey, you never quite know how important sound is in film until you actually hear sometimes. Even like we saw recently, and we did a show on it, but we saw Princess Mononoke, and we saw it in theaters, like in a theater for the first time. And I remember, like, we both were at the very end, we're like, at the very beginning, did you know those sounds were going on? Like, neither of us had ever seen that movie how many times, never heard those sounds. Like, a lot of times, not in quality, the sound is a very important part of movies. So,
I mean, we've typically only watch that film on DVD at home. So when you upgrade to Blu-ray, Blu-ray has, you know, high definition sound too. So we're just not familiar with that cut, you know, take of it. So seeing it in a theater with theater speakers was something impressive. So to watch something like Close Encounters, which is known for its sound, is just something special. There's something special about the movie in general. It's one of my favorite Spielberg movies, personally. Yes, it's not one I watch all the time, much like Jaws. Like, I'll watch Jaws once a year, as you do. I'll watch Hook. I do watch Hook once a year.
Jurassic Park.
Jurassic Park very often, Indiana Jones very often, but like some like Close Encounters, like I'll watch once every 5 years, something like that. I wait until I almost forget about it, kind of thing.
Yeah. And it ropes you back in.
Yeah, it's an unexplainable phenomenon.
Indeed.
You know what's great also about this movie is how Richard Dreyfuss got his role in this movie. Because, like I said, Spielberg started working on this film while they were finishing up Jaws. So he's on set, and Richard Dreyfuss is there. And him and Richard Dreyfuss are good friends. They have a lot of similar thoughts and feelings about life in the world. So they kind of connected pretty early on from meeting each other. So when Spielberg's explaining his movie, Richard Dreyfuss is giving suggestions, and they're kind of like not working on this film together, but you know, just taking his suggestions and just like brainstorming.
He's like, "What if there were giant piranhas?"
And it got to the point where Richard Dreyfuss is like, "I want to play your character of Roy." And Spielberg's like, no, you're not my Roy, because at that time, Roy was going to be a military man, and Spielberg only saw Richard Dreyfuss as this, you know, biologist who wrote for the National Geographic, because he's working on Jaws. And Spielberg wanted all kinds of actors to play this role, from Al Pacino, Dustin Hoffman, to Jack Nicholson. All of them turned it down or passed on it for one reason or another. And it got down to it where Spielberg's like, my guy is Steve McQueen. He wanted Steve McQueen to play Roy. And at this point, this is when they changed it from a military guy to, I guess, the everyday man. And so McQueen read the script and wanted to meet with Spielberg. And they met, and McQueen told him that he wasn't going to take the role. He couldn't, because at the end, the character cries as he turns, and he gets emotional. He's like, I can't cry. Like, I can't cry in movies. I almost did reading the script, but this isn't me. And Spielberg was kind of like at a loss, like didn't know who's going to play this role now. And all along the way, Richard Dreyfuss is like, let me play this guy. To the point where anytime Spielberg's like, oh, we're looking at Al Pacino or Dustin Hoffman or whoever, Dreyfuss is like turning it down. Like, they're not going to want to do it. They're going to ask for too much money. He's too crazy. Like, any little nudge to get him in the role he was making. And then Dreyfuss, one final time, was like, listen, you need a child to play this role. And Spielberg was just like, you know what? You're right. You get the part.
He's like, Steven, you are seconds from death.
Like, all right.
I will be in this movie. He's like, calm down, you cry baby.
Exactly.
Like, yeah, that's good. Let's put that in the movie.
Let's see you eat some mashed potatoes.
Yeah.
There's a dead fly in my potatoes.
Jesus.
That's my favorite line.
There's the Jaws dinner scene, and then there's this dinner scene.
So might want to let that breathe.
Would it have been better if this time Roy Scheider would have stopped by?
Whoa.
And brought in just a keg?
That would have fucked hard.
Indeed.
Instead of that French guy, they had Robert Shaw play.
Well, he'd be so drunk. What if we made this movie today? Indeed. So in this part of the shows, we take the film we just watched and we imagine what it would look like if it came out today. Who would direct it? Who would compose? Who would star? Same story, same film, just a different cast and crew for the modern booking. So with that being said, Close Encounters of the Third Kind, if it came out today, who would direct it? Who would compose it? Who would be our Roy, our Jillian, and then who else do you want to cast?
I had in mind Roy, Jillian, and his wife.
Ronnie.
Okay, Ronnie.
Yeah, Ronnie. Alrighty, good by me. So who you got?
Where do you want to start?
Well, who you got in the director's chair?
For my take of Close Encounters of the Third Kind, is a director who has yet to do a sci-fi film, but he does great dramatical work, and that would be David O. Russell.
David O. Russell
has made The Fighter, Silver Linings Playbook, American Hustle, Joy, amongst others. I like his work with certain actors and how he kind of constructs his films. They're very entertaining, yet they draw you in with their drama, especially films like The Fighter and Silver Linings Playbook. Great films, and I think he's a great director as well.
Indeed. I honestly, when I was thinking of directors to choose, I was like, who's a director we could get in the director's chair that's not as utilized on a podcast? And I almost went with Bradley Cooper because I'm like, yeah, he's an up-and-coming director. He's done some films. He could star in it, too. But I was like, nah, that's fine. But ultimately, I chose Terry Gilliam. Honestly, when I looked up his, I was mostly thinking of his sci-fi work with, like, 12 Monkeys and that. But then, like, I was thinking Brothers Grimm is not a sci-fi, it's more of a fantasy, but it's got, like, the whimsy to it, but also the horror aspects. And I thought of, like, Imaginarium of Dr. Parnassus, which, again, is a movie that he has a way of, like, portraying a lot of different aspects. And that's a movie that I really enjoy. I haven't really watched enough. Were you aware that he directed Monty Python and the Holy Grail?
Yeah,
I had no clue.
Yeah. He directed a lot of those Monty Python things.
Yeah.
The original crew.
Yeah, I had no clue. But, and he did things like The Fisher King and Fear and Loathing in Las Angeles.
Las Vegas.
Yeah, most recently. Las Vegas. Most recently, The Man Who Killed Don Quixote.
I need to check. I haven't, but I haven't seen it.
He's a really good actor, or director, rather, and he does portray, especially in 12 Monkeys, he portrays sci-fi really well. I was torn between him and Luc Besson, of Valerian fame, obviously.
Fifth Element.
Yeah. That was where I was going, but I feel like we just used him recently. I think I tried to use him for Star Wars, I think.
Maybe.
Yeah. But
you want someone who's more on, like, the dramatic side.
Yeah, and I think we've used or at least suggested Terry Gilliam before, but I don't know if we've used him. So Terry Gilliam is my choice there.
Let's flip real for it.
Alrighty.
Heads you, tails me. And we got tails.
Indeed, David O. Russell. Alrighty. Next up, then, a composer.
One we've used, not a lot, but more often. Actually, I think we've only suggested once, and that was recently, and that would be Thomas Newman. Great composer. He's done things like American Beauty, Meet Joe Black, Red Dead Redemption, Shawshank, Skyfall. But his work in 1917 has been my favorite as of late.
Ah, so good.
He's done a plethora of others. I once knew somebody. I asked them their favorite movies, and they said anything Thomas Newman does. I'm like, that's a weird answer, but I respect it. This is a thought you don't usually have. Like, what are your favorite movies? Like, anything that this certain composer does, I'll check out. But he is a great composer. And just to to recreate something as iconic as John Williams' score, who's often regarded as the greatest film composer of all time, and I just said this score is one of my favorites of his, it was a tough, tough pick.
Yeah, and because of that, because of, you know, you're taking an actor, or I keep saying actor, but you're taking a director, a director and a composer pair of Spielberg and John Williams, that I was, like, really torn at first. I was like, who do I want to find for this? And I think ultimately my pick for a composer is the right pick. We've used him before, and that's Michael Giacchino. And that's mostly based just in thinking he did Rogue One, so he's done a Spielberg movie. He did Star Trek. That's another gigantic sci-fi franchise. And then he's done things like The Incredibles, Ratatouille, War of the Planet of the Apes. He's working on The Batman that's coming out.
Sounds pretty cool.
He did Jurassic World Fallen Kingdom and Zootopia and Spider-Man Far From Home. Like he's quickly becoming one of the more well-known composers of movies now. And even to his credit, doing things like Fringe, which was a huge sci-fi TV series. And smaller movies like 50-50. Mission Impossible Ghost Protocol. He's really done tons of different movies, did music for Lost, and a lot of different things. So I think he's a good pick for that, because I feel that he has done enough sci-fi, and he's also already handled the, you know, iconic scores of John Williams. So I feel like he would do a fine job.
You want me to flip you for it?
Do whatever you feel.
I will do what I must.
Yes.
And it is your pick.
Hey.
Giacchino.
All right.
He is the Hollywood go-to nowadays, which is just fine.
Yeah, he does a good job. I really like the Rogue One scores, so I think he's a solid slot there. What about Ronnie? Let's go with the wife.
Ronnie? I'm constructing my actors with my director, so I picked David O. Russell as my director. So as far as my cast goes for this role, it might seem a little similar to her role in American Hustle, but I'm going with Jennifer Lawrence.
Okay.
For the role of Ronnie. Oscar-winning actress, can kind of play the range of all kinds of characters, and in a very subtle way, Ronnie is... she's not seen much in the film. She's very memorable, and she kind of portrays a very realistic, unhappy wife, which can be difficult to pull off. And Terry Garr did to great success back in the day. But Jennifer Lawrence is one of our actress greats of today. So let's throw her in Ronnie's slippers.
So who I went with for this one. So ultimately for this, for Ronnie, I wanted to choose an actress that could be seen, because when I'm watching this movie and you see Ronnie, Terry Garr's character, she's almost like not trophy wife, but she's very like a beautiful woman and stuff like that. So I wanted to go with someone that could fill that role. And I've seen her do other things similar to this role in a sense. And that's Blake Lively. We've never used her before. I feel like she'd be a good fit for that role of like just the wife role that is kind of has that emotional range of like being really, really serious. But also like loving and worried and nervous and things like that. So I ultimately went with Blake Lively, mostly because we've never used her before. I do think she'd be a good fit as well.
Yeah. And she also has to be a little playful too. There's that scene where Roy drags the family out to see the lights, but they're no longer there. And, you know, says like, don't you think I'm taking this very well? And she flirts with him and, yeah, there's a lot to her character, although briefly seen on screen.
Yeah, originally I was going to go with Margot Robbie, but we've used her a lot, so I went against it.
Right on. So I'm going to flip you once again. Heads to you, tails me, and hey, you got it again.
Ayo. Alrighty. Ayo. Next up then, Jillian. I'm going for you, Jillian.
Jillian, I'm sticking with my David O. Russell cast thing here, so I'm going with Amy Adams. She's been in a few of his films, including The Fighter, where I believe she was nominated for an Oscar, and American Hustle, where she once again was nominated for an Oscar. The role of Jillian, Melinda...
she's also dealt with aliens before.
Yeah, it's true. She knows how to communicate with them.
Yeah.
You know, they... the actress, Melinda... What is her last name?
In this, Melinda Dillon?
Yeah. she was hired the weekend before they started shooting. And she didn't read the script or anything. And here at the end of the film, she was actually nominated for an Oscar for playing this role. So this is a very important role. And who better than Amy Adams?
Hey, how about? I'll tell you who's better. Ultimately, I went with an actress that's been in a lot more as of late. First saw her in, and I think she fits this role really well. First saw her in Handmaid's Tale, and then in Us, and then in most recently The Invisible Man. And that's Elizabeth Moss. I think Elizabeth Moss fits this character because I've seen I haven't seen Invisible Man yet. I've seen enough of it. You have seen it?
Yes, I did.
Is she good?
The last movie I saw in the theater. Yeah, she was great. Cried a lot.
Well, she kind of has to do some of that in this movie.
Just some.
And but also, in sticking with that, I'm thinking of like her serious take, and I've seen most of the first season of Handmaid's Tale, and then and seeing her in the movie Us, where she's a little different of a character, but still can have, she's shown range, I guess is what I'm getting at. And I think she would fit this role well because she kind of has to have like the hysterical sense to her, but also be caring and loving and things like that. So I think she would be a good fit.
Let's flip her again. And we got May.
Hey.
May Adams.
You won.
Maybe she'll actually win an Oscar this time.
Maybe. Don't get your hopes up. All right. Well, then, last character here. We got old Roy.
Roy Neary. For me, and sticking with David Russell, I tossed around a couple actors. At one point, I had Bradley Cooper in mind, like you mentioned. Then I switched to like Christian Bale, but then at one point I even had Mark Wahlberg in mind, and I was like, "There's no way I'd be able to."
Like all these guys are too good looking.
Yeah, so I actually ended up going with Jeremy Renner.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, Jeremy Renner, who
he's got a punchable face, huh?
Yeah, just like Richard Dreyfuss.
I guess.
Jeremy Renner, who was an American Hustle, nominated for American Hustle. Oh, no, he wasn't nominated for that. But he was nominated for Hurt Locker for Best Actor. And he's probably mostly well-known nowadays for being in the Marvel films.
Hawkeye.
But, you know, there's a lot of heart in his performances and a lot of heart in his face, as punchable as it is. But he could be my everyman, although he plays the superhero and he kind of is thrown in these extraordinary situations. I've kind of grown to like him more and more as an actor, especially if you see him in something like American Hustle, where he plays like a mayor. But his portrayal of the mayor is very, like, down-to-earth, one of the people kind of thing. And, yeah, I would like to see him in this kind of situation of Roy Neary.
Well, hey, Amy Adams and him were in Arrival together, right?
And they were in Arrival together.
Yeah.
That's true.
My pick for Roy is an actor that, honestly, growing up, I remember thinking, I'm like, this guy's not in a lot of stuff, and he's pretty good. And now I seem to see him in more and more things. Just finished season 2. I actually watched a show. Look at that. I watched it with a wife. We watched the show Dead to Me on Netflix. And one of the main characters is played by James Marsden. And
handsome.
Yeah, handsome, very handsome. And I decided to go with James Marsden, mostly because of his portrayal of the character he has in the first season. He's Steve Wood, and then in the second season, he's a different character, portrayed. He plays his brother. They're twins. His twin brother, Ben. And his portrayal of Ben is his brother Steve is like a jock, and his brother Ben is he's like a doctor. He's like a pencil pusher, nerdy, very lame, doesn't drink. And there's a scene where gets drunk and he kisses the main character, and the next day the main character's like, that was a mistake. He's like, oh my god, did something happen? I was like two shots in. I forgot everything. He's like very nerdy and goofy. But also seeing him in Westworld, where in Westworld he is it's not really a spoiler because it happens in the first episode, but he's a robot in Westworld. And that show is all about him, he's part of it, he's part of the story, but he's like slowly finding out, figuring out that something's wrong. He's kind of has a moment of madness at one point, especially in the first episode. So I thought he would be a good fit for this role, old James Marsden.
And he's handsome.
Yeah, and maybe the aliens kill him at the end because it's James Marsden.
Because he's Cyclops.
Yeah, and he has to die. Unceremoniously, off screen.
All right, here we go. Heads you, tails me. That was a big flip, so let's see. Ah, it is tails.
There you go. All right, there you go. And I did want to throw out, James Marsden was Prince Edward in Enchanted with Amy Adams. So.
And I want to throw out, he is in Hop.
He is also in Sonic the Hedgehog.
True.
But as we were. So, Close Encounters of the Third Kind remake. We got David O. Russell directing, Michael Giacchino composing, Blake Lively as Ronnie, Amy Adams as Jillian, and we got Jeremy Renner as Roy, my boy. And that is the film. So, before we get going, anything else you want to discuss before we head?
There's one very important thing I didn't mention about the movie while we were discussing the making of it and whatnot. But Spielberg created this film in 1977. He as a person, was a child of divorce at a very young age, and it affected him very much so. And a lot of his films, he incorporates a separated parents or a missing father figure, and most of his stories are centered around a boy. And that's been a theme of his throughout his films. And this stems from his parents separating, which, like I said, affected him very much. His mother was a musician. She was a celloist, or cellist. And his father worked on computers. He was a technician. And so he went throughout his career. And it wasn't until the 90s when he, or maybe it was the 2000s, he was on Inside the Actor's Studio, James Lipton. And you can look this clip up on YouTube, and it's just the clip, so you don't have to watch a whole episode. But James Lipton explains to Spielberg that concept that his father worked with computers, his mother was a musician, and in Close Encounters of the Third Kind, that's how they communicate. That's how they come together, is through technology and music. And it was only in that moment that Spielberg realized that. He's like, I never put that together until just now. All those years later, subconsciously, he was reaching out for an answer, an understanding. And the best way he could portray that in a movie was through computers and music. And I find that to be extremely beautiful and something special about the movie itself.
Indeed, indeed, indeed. Powerful stuff. But with that being said, why don't we close it out on that sad, depressing note. and so that was the show. We hope you enjoyed it.
It is nice.
But we'll close it out on that note. So that is the show, everyone. We hope you enjoyed it. If you liked what you heard, be sure to check us out over on Audio Boom if you haven't already. That is our primary site. That's where we post the podcast to first, and subsequently they ship it out everywhere else. So Google Play, Stitcher Radio, iTunes, Spotify, wherever you get podcasts, we're there. You can also find us on Twitter. We are at the Bros Movie Pod. That's where we post in links to things we'll be watching that week. Memes that Gus makes and other tweets along the way. You can also find us on Facebook.
Go to Facebook and you don't type in the Brothers Movie Factory, you're doing things wrong. You should go there, type us in, Like us, share what we post, follow along as I like to post memes and pictures of what we're watching each and every week, as well as links to the things Ben mentioned a moment ago, to Audioboom, Spotify, Twitter, and that.
Alrighty, and that is the show. We hope you enjoyed it, but until next week, brothers.
Brothers.
Brothers. Brothers.